So I'm Simon Nelson, I'm CEO of FutureLearn. My belief is audio is one of the most flexible, powerful mediums. It tells stories, it gets in your head in ways that other media find it very difficult. And I am delighted to be trying to encourage this new podcast to find the audience it deserves.
Hello everyone, welcome to the EdTech Podcast, the show about education innovation in and out of the classroom. Thanks to everyone who came out and celebrated our first birthday at the Joker Pub this week. It was brilliant to meet and catch up with so many of you, and a big shout out to Glisser for covering the first drinks. I was really chuffed to see people there from outside of London, and even to receive a few cards, including the one titled "I'm Sorry Your Boss is Psycho," which I especially liked. This week we kicked off our Patreon campaign and listener survey. A huge shout out to Deval Shah of Class Central in the US, Chantal Schoen-Bichler and the team at PyTop, and Rachel Doyle of Crazy Fig Marketing for adding your pledges variously as fans, groupies and Billy Big Ball patrons under my official terminology. As patrons, you help keep the EdTech podcast going, covering everything from Libsyn hosting, Skype costs, Google and Buffer to help get listener guest messages out to as many people as possible. If you're interested to find out more, you can check out the site at www.patreon.com/the EdTech podcast. Don't also forget the listener survey, which takes 4 minutes to complete and will help us keep making the content you want to hear more of. Details are in the show notes. This week I'm prepping up for my trip to ASU GSV, where I've just heard off the record that US Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos will be speaking, so keep your eyes peeled for that. Sadly, we didn't bring home the gold at the British Podcaster Awards, but thanks to everyone for voting and we're very hopeful for next time. In other news, I'm very excited to announce that the Japan Prize will be sharing their message with the EdTech podcast. Here's a snippet from my conversation with Yuki Yoshida, Deputy Secretary General of the NHK Japan Prize, with more details.
Hello.
Hello, good morning to you.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, and you?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, we had a really nice weekend in London. It was very sunny. Perhaps you could explain to listeners what the Japan Prize is.
Okay, my pleasure. First of all, NHK is Japan's public broadcaster. So, and we usually produce almost every genre of content, like TV programs and radio programs. And but also, NHK put much importance on education. And one of the international brands to represent that value or almost expressing our how determined we are about quality or equal access to education is the Japan Prize. It's an international competition for educational media. And so we launched this competition in 1965. So we welcome all of the audiovisual contents, not only TV programs and videos and films, but also we welcome all the digital contents as well, such as website and games and applications. So this is pretty much about what we are.
And so in terms of who should enter, are there any particular types of digital companies, edtech companies, who should definitely enter? And are there any that you're thinking in the future may be eligible but aren't this time around?
Okay, so because we are public media broadcaster, now we're welcoming the content which has any type of audiovisual contents in their services. So like website or across, even though it's a cross media content, like teaching kids as programming or coding, the content should have some sort of audiovisual contents in that service. So maybe some sort of like a robot who are controlled by the coding, but if that robot doesn't have audiovisual contents at the moment, I think I'm sorry to have to tell that I think we have to wait for a little more to come to welcome those contents.
So it's the audiovisual bit that's the important aspect. Mm,
that's right. Yes.
Okay. And then is there a cost to enter?
No, there is no entry fee. So any contents are welcome. And we already opened the call for entry for this year. So you can just simply visit our website, and we have all the entry rules and entry forms. Links are there.
Okay, great. And then the deadline is the 30th of June this year. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Okay. So until that light, we have about two steps to enter. One is the filling out the online entry form. And after we accept the entry form, we will send you the email to your the links to upload your contents. And so the finishing the uploading the contents, it should be done by the deadline, which is just like you said, at end of the June. So that's www.nhk.or.jp/prize.
If people enter and they're successful, what's the benefit? What's the next step if they go on to be nominated or win?
Right, okay. So after the deadline, we have a preliminary selection process during the summer. We are announcing the finalists on September the 1st. And after you are nominated, some of the category, not all of the category, but you are welcome to present your works in Tokyo. Especially for the EdTech listener, I think it's one of the good news, I hope, is that one category, which is heavily focusing on digital content, which we are calling Creative Frontier category, these are five or six finalists who are usually nominated as a finalist. And these finalists are invited by NHK. We are paying your travel cost. You are invited to Tokyo to present your project in front of the final jurors.
And
so that will, so you have a free ticket to Tokyo.
Okay, fantastic. And then the award giving ceremony, that is in the autumn, is that right?
Yes, the final selection will be scheduled from October 11th to October 18th. The final date, October 18th, is the award ceremony. So this is the one day which we, you know, announced all the winners. And we have a best of the best prize, which is called the Grand Prix Japan Prize. So these are, you know, presented all the winners. And we have a prize money. Each of the best category, we have $2,000 for the winner. And also we have $5,000 for the Grand Prix winners. So I think it's I hope it's a good information for you.
Yeah, no, I think it's very good. I think a lot of people will be excited and interested to enter. So thank you very much for sharing, Yuki. Do you have any final message to potential entrants?
Well, we all the believing in the power of media and power of technology to change the world for the better place. And the Japan Prize is a very unique place for those people who get together and discuss how the media can communicate to the world in the learning aspect. So we're really looking forward to your submissions, and we're really looking forward to welcoming you to Tokyo in October.
That's great. So thanks very much, Yuki.
Thank you, Sophie.
Now on to this week. This week is the second of a 7-episode series from this year's South by Southwest EDU. I'm in conversation with Simon Nelson, the CEO of FutureLearn, Brian McDonald, the Director for Residential Education at UCLA in Los Angeles, Deval Shah, founder of Class Central, and Niklas Ljunggard, founder and CEO at SCORE from Sweden. We're talking about higher education and MOOCs. Is higher education innovating fast enough? And what are the latest trends in online courses, corporate training, and MOOCs? Let's find out. Today we're here at South by Southwest Edu at the Hilton. I'm delighted to be here with Simon Nelson. And Simon, could you introduce yourself for those who don't know you and what you do and FutureLearn as well, please?
Sure. So I'm Chief Executive of FutureLearn, which is a startup spin-off of the Open University that I founded just over 4 years ago. And we've been building it up over time. We've developed what we think is one of the best online learning platforms in the world. And we now have partnerships with around a quarter of the world's top universities who are offering largely free open online courses through FutureLearn.
And your presentation here, so I've got the title here, HE needs to go digital or go home. So I love the title, but can you explain a little bit about what you'll be chatting about this afternoon?
Sure. So my background is not from higher education. I was actually at the BBC for 15 years. And during that time, the BBC underwent quite a sizable shift in its role from what was an analog market to what was a much more digital market. And I believe higher education is going through the same shift at the moment. And we believe that we have the kind of services and platforms and skills that can help the universities, particularly in that sector, navigate the challenges, but also exploit the amazing opportunities that that offers.
I mean, in your opinion, do you think that higher education is, as a sector, is it innovating fast enough?
I'd say there's fantastic pockets of innovation all around the sector, and there's been a real acceleration in the last few years. But I wouldn't say I know of a single institution that I believe is moving fast enough to really take advantage of quite a fundamental shift in who you can reach and how they can learn.
If higher education doesn't innovate fast enough, I mean, what's the greatest risk that just a sort of left field supplier comes in and takes that space and, you know, it does more modular forms of education? What's your kind of vision of the alternative if they don't adapt?
So there already are a whole range of new entrants coming in. I don't believe that the arrival of digital sweeps away incumbents in an industry, but I believe that those who move fastest can secure a really strong position in the new emerging market. And we want to work with universities to help them take advantage of those opportunities. So I do think that there's going to be a wide range of new entrants, a wide range of new services there to be offered. And I think that those universities that don't move fast enough just risk losing relevance with their existing sort of customer base, but also missing out on some of the opportunities to really broaden their impact around the world.
And of your courses, so as I understand, I think you have, is it 5 million users now?
Nearly 6 million.
You bumped it up a million, so yeah. Congratulations on that. Of the course providers, which course providers are the most popular on your platform?
So our biggest courses by some degree have been from the British Council, who have developed a suite of English language courses. So for people with intermediate English who want to improve it in key areas. And some of those courses have attracted well into the hundreds of thousands of learners to each individual run. But we also have a huge range of courses that attract much smaller audiences, but still possibly the largest single audience that's ever studied that quite niche subject. So we have hundreds of courses now attracting anything from 1,000 to our biggest course, nearly 500,000 people.
And I mean, I know that the CEO of Class Central is here today. I don't know if you know, you're familiar with them.
Yeah, I know them. I know him, and I'm looking forward to meeting him tomorrow.
Okay, excellent. So
he says very nice things about FutureLearn.
That's good to hear. And I mean, I guess so. They're sort of an aggregator of services that you could choose, and so on. I guess my question on that one was, having looked at some of their reports, it seems that the sort of actual revenues in MOOCs has sort of moved towards corporate learning perhaps, and I just wondered on FutureLearn's model where, you know, how much you can tell us about revenues and where perhaps that's coming from as well.
Sure. So there's definitely been quite a significant upturn in revenues for the different players in the market, and FutureLearn's no different. So this year we will generate millions of revenue. That will come kind of equally from consumers directly, but also from institutions. And that could be corporates, but it can also be the kind of universities that we're dealing with and the additional services we provide to them. So where I see this going, I think corporate is going to be a big play for some of the people in the market. But there is a vast consumer audience all around the world that is crying out for more flexible, enjoyable modes of learning to help them get jobs, help them progress in jobs. So sometimes that purchase will be facilitated through the employer, the corporate, for example, but sometimes it will be directly with the learner. And I think what you're also seeing is kind of modularization of the whole process of gaining a degree qualification. Mm-hmm. So at FutureLearn, just last week, we launched degrees on the platform for the first time. Yeah. Where one of our partners, Deakin University in Australia, is effectively breaking down the whole of a master's degree into the courses and programs that we use as kind of units of learning currency on FutureLearn. And that transforms the flexibility and accessibility of a degree for a much wider range of people who are in work, who are caring, who are parents, etc. So these are big, big markets that are being digitized. And so I see our revenues and revenues in the sector coming from a wide range of consumer and business relationships.
And where are those consumers based? So, I mean, I'm guessing there's people all over the world that take part in FutureLearn, but where, say, your top three users based?
So, yeah, we have learners in just about every country in the world. Our biggest country is, of course, the UK, which is where we started, but around three quarters of our audience now are from outside the UK. We're a heavily Anglophone platform, so our next biggest market is the US. Australia is obviously a big market. And we also are starting to make inroads in India, China, etc. So there's a very long tail, though, and we're as proud of the fact that our Ebola course had 3% of its audience coming from Sierra Leone at the height of the last Ebola outbreak. So we have the ability now to reach pretty much anyone, anywhere, with an internet connection. And that's an incredibly exciting development for us and for the partners we're working with.
And at the moment, I'm guessing, so it's sort of fairly traditional MOOC content, if you could call it that. Do you see FutureLearn diversifying into other forms of content? So, for example, in a couple of weeks, I'm interviewing a mobile gaming company that have developed a mobile game to teach language learning. And I just wondered if there's any plans to sort of offer different forms of content as well.
So at FutureLearn, we very much put our emphasis and focus on social learning. So we actually think we've built a social network for learning and for learners. And the content that our partners create is intended to be a catalyst to ignite discussion among learners, which is where we think learning really happens. Now, we think we're close to world leaders in this area, but we're still just scratching the surface of what's possible. And so I think our innovations will be around where that social learning goes. So group-based learning, for example, actually getting learners to help each other and to develop reputation that enables them to educate each other more powerfully. These are some of the directions we might go in. But we also enable partners with their own innovations to showcase them through the courses. So we create what we describe as exercise steps, which are effectively windows out of a FutureLearn course into another environment where someone might have created an innovative assessment tool, for example, or a simulation tool. So actually that opens a whole range of other sort of technologies and interactive content to be contained within the FutureLearn experience.
Interesting. So I can imagine sort of VR or AR content that's for an educational purpose perhaps on there as well.
Very much so. Very interested in seeing what we could do with VR, but also at more basic levels. We're talking at the moment on an audio podcast. I think there's a hell of a lot more that could be done with just audio, actually, in these kind of courses.
Well, that was one of my questions, actually. So having seen that you were a digital lead for radio, I think at the BBC, if you had any tips for a podcaster or for people listening in who are obviously interested and excited about podcasts, you know, I guess you were there right at the beginning, so...
So I was in charge of digital developments for BBC Radio from late 90s until about 2007. So we launched the BBC's first on-demand service, the Radio Player, which later spun out into the iPlayer. And one of my proudest memories is discovering and launching podcasting from the BBC. And I think the BBC is still one of the leading players, if not the leading player, in podcasting around the world. And what I loved was the way it rejuvenated parts of radio that people assumed were sort of dying or dead in a new digital world. So speech radio, factual programming, etc., suddenly had new life breathed into it as you could consume it on demand, and it had a chance to really reach the audiences who'd be most passionate about it. So my belief is audio is one of the most flexible, powerful mediums. It tells stories, it gets in your head in ways that other media find it very difficult. And I am delighted to be trying to encourage
this
new podcast to find the audience it deserves.
It's true though. I think there's a podcast called Hardcore Histories, and each episode is about 3 hours long, and there's about 200 episodes. So, I mean, it's got a massive following, so very interesting. Oh, that's my next question. So we're talking about the BBC. I mean, what role do you think mainstream media brands like news broadcasters have to play in education?
So mainstream media brands could play a very powerful role in education, and the BBC in particular could be a world leader in this area. It's been stung by some of its previous involvement in learning. It was very much sort of pushed out of certain sectors by the industry that claimed it was crowding it out, which was a great shame, because actually the BBC has an enormous amount to offer. I think, however, if you just look at the educational content that comes out of an organisation like the BBC day in, day out, on its broadcast channels, but also on its website, from news to factual programming, then actually it already has a very powerful educational impact. What needs to happen is that it's easier for other providers like ourselves at FutureLearn, or the whole range of startups that are going to be here today in Austin, Texas, to connect with and to share some of the spotlight that the BBC can shine on other providers who will go a lot deeper into those educational areas. And I know there's people at the BBC looking at this hard and thinking about it and making the organisation more porous, but also something that players like us can kind of bolt onto and really take advantage of the wealth of untapped educational resource there is in that BBC archive.
And what was your own education like, Simon? So growing up?
So I was very fortunate. I went to a really, really good school in Manchester, which my parents could afford to send me to. And I quickly established a passion for Latin and Greek and ancient history. And what I still find staggering about my own education is that from the age of 15... I studied nothing but Latin, Greek, and ancient history until around the age of 24, having failed to get a significant job. I decided I had to do an MBA part-time to supplement my work at Dimples, Wigs, and Toupees. My first job.
So does that perhaps give an inkling that you were thinking of going into theatre? Or
classics? No, I just
the wig shop. Or you just like wigs? I don't know.
No, it's more a reflection of the fact that I graduated in the last big recession, and as I saw many friends and colleagues heading off into accountancy or consultancy, I wanted to do something a bit different, and I actually loved that job. I did it for 3.5 years. I got to manage a small business. But doing the MBA part-time at Manchester Business School was also kind of the perfect training and support for running a small business in that way. And I came out of that experience ready for and with a pathway into what became a very, very exciting period at the BBC. And now the most fulfilling part of my career, running FutureLearn.
And I suppose even doing that part-time MBA also is a bit of a precursor to, you know, your philosophy of education with FutureLearn.
Very much so. I saw a lot of people who were doing full-time MBAs over 2 years, coming out, at the time, 30,000, 40,000 in debt, and I could not understand how you could walk straight out of an MBA into some of the high-powered jobs these guys were targeting. My real formative experience was, you know, coming out of a day of lectures on operations strategy or strategic marketing, and then having to convince my chairman to change our approach, and it was actually translating it back into the workplace and the day-to-day operations of a small business where I got the most learning.
And is Dimples still going?
Dimples is still going. I think it's still about
big shout out to Dimples.
Number three in the UK wig market.
Yeah. That's amazing. Well, I'm definitely going to put that in the show notes. So, final question. I always ask people whether they have any books or resources or people that had a significant impact on how you think. So it doesn't have to be educational stuff. It could be anything, but sort of that you maybe something that you go back to quite regularly.
Oh, that is a very difficult question. What do I go back to regularly? So throughout my career, I've been incredibly fortunate to be able to move very fast and be part of rapidly growing parts of the business. So I was building digital teams and running them and always facing new challenges and winning new investment. And it's been the same in education so far. But that does mean you run at quite a breathless pace. And a very, very wise boss I had at the BBC spotted that I was outpacing my team and forced me to take some coaching, which at the time I really tried to resist, but rapidly I think transformed my effectiveness as a leader. It's a well I've had to go back to repeatedly in different roles as I've faced different challenges, and I think that ability to call on a kind of mentoring and coaching network I have found absolutely essential to develop myself and just stay sane in a rapidly moving world.
That's a very good point. And if people are listening in and they would, you know, either if it's a higher education institution or a school that perhaps wants to know how to use your courses for student progression, how do they contact you or how can they find out more?
Get to futurelearn.com and have a look at the fantastic range of courses we have available. There's abilities to contact us through that website. And if people are particularly interested in contacting me directly, simon.nelson@futurelearn.com. Be interested to hear what people think.
Thanks very much, Simon. Next up, a word from Class Central, which if you're into geeking out over online learning and MOOC reports like I am, you'll probably already know about. Unless you've been asleep, MOOCs or massive online open courses are changing the way we experience higher and further education and workplace learning. With significant online courses available, gaining insight into this fast-paced world is worth spending time on, especially for those implicated by such changes. That's where Class Central comes in. Not only does it list hundreds of courses, and importantly, including non-profit courses as well as the big Ivy League unis, but the MOOC Report blog has some excellent analysis on what's up, down, new, or just slightly left field. I came across Class Central when I was preparing for a Department for International Trade webinar and found it invaluable. Since then, I've met the founder out at South by Southwest EDU, and he was excited to share the resource with all of you. So definitely go and check it out at www.class-central.com/report and let me know what you think. Okay, great. So Brian and I have finally found one another in the Austin Convention Centre. And Brian, perhaps you could introduce yourself, what you do and why you're here at South by Southwest as well.
Sure. My name is Brian McDonald. I'm the Director of Residential Education at UCLA. So for the 20,000 students who live on campus, our team, our department works with everyone to make sure that living at UCLA is as exciting and as safe and as satisfying as it can possibly be.
So in terms of residential education, mm-hmm. what does that, when you break that down, what does that mean as well?
So I think it means that this idea that learning is a continuous process and that college students don't just go to class mm-hmm. and then they leave class and they're done learning. So much of the education that happens at a university, of course, happens in the classroom, but a lot of it happens outside the classroom. And so there's a tremendous amount of energy at UCLA that we put into maximizing, you know, what are students learning from one another in a dining hall? What are they learning from one another when they're doing community service? What are they learning in internships? What are they learning from their roommates? What are they learning from, you know, when their actions impact, you know, the 1,000 or 500 other people who live in their building? What kind of education spaces can we create in the, you know, the residence halls or the dorms, as they're affectionately called, so that when students want to build things, so, you know, we're building a makerspace in our residence halls, not attached to a school of engineering, right? But what are some other things we can do as we build out spaces like that to intersect other values of community and diversity and social justice and sustainability? And so that's sort of that's kind of the vibe of what we try to do.
That's really interesting. And I mean, there's a session here on academic incubators, and I spoke to a professor at MIT on an academic incubator there, and UCL in London have just launched one called Educate. And it strikes me that higher education institutions are, you know, realizing they need to sort of populate these experiences outside of the lecture hall and kind of cater for that entrepreneurial type of student, which, if you believe the kind of marketing facets of what a millennial is, would be something that perhaps they would need more so even than perhaps prior students. So I wondered whether this role that you have, is that something that you're seeing across multiple universities? Is it quite unique to UCLA, or is there a kind of body of representative of what you do there?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the kind of the industry of student affairs, student leadership, mm-hmm. student development has been going on as long as there's been universities in the U.S. And so I think how it's taken form, you know, it took place, it was very different at the beginning of the education system in the U.S. It was different in the civil rights movement, and it's different now. Mm. So across history, you can see where, you know, there's been, so during the civil rights movements, it wasn't presidents or faculty members who were stepping into student protests, it was deans of students. Similarly now, you know, certainly our faculty and our administration do a lot to help our students, but, you know, when a student's in a mental health crisis and mm-hmm. is thinking about, you know, hurting themselves or hurting someone else, or they've made a mistake, or they can't pay for school, or a family member has died, or they don't know what to major in, they don't know what they're going to graduate, of course they can seek that out from a professor, of course they can seek that out from an alumni, but there are people who specifically occupy positions at universities that have been doing this work for a long time. And I think now that higher ed in America is really being questioned in terms of what mm-hmm. value does it bring, it's time to really shine a light on those outside the classroom experiences. And now they're getting thrust even more so into the public dialogue, as you're seeing, again, some of these more, you know, with the rise of entrepreneurship and with the rise of design and innovation as a focus, the best way to do that is through an interdisciplinary approach. To do that, you need to know how to work as a team. You need to have emotional intelligence. You need to know how to deal with conflict. Those are all skills that you may not learn in a classroom.
Within higher education, I mean, what, in particular with your role, what are the biggest challenges and opportunities? So you're here at South by Southwest EDU. You're going to get to see lots of interesting things. What do you hope to sort of take away from that mm-hmm. that will be practical for you?
So what's practical for me is here, there's people from all over education. And I think, you know, one of the biggest issues on college campuses, especially the competitive ones like UCLA, is the mental health of our students. Mm-hmm. The stress on our counseling center, the number of students who think about hurting themselves, students who cite anxiety as something that gets in the way of their studies. We've never seen numbers like this. We've never seen this many college students show up on medication. We can't fix that without talking to our partners in K through 12, right? And I think mm-hmm. It's so interesting that, you know, how we don't do that enough, where you put K through 12, special education, private, public, you know, all under one roof and have a conversation about just learning, about community. And I think that's the number one thing I'm looking forward to, because there are some, you know, I referenced mental health. That's probably the number one thing that gets in the way of us helping students use college to be a time where they figure out what they're most passionate about and then go out and change the world, right? Is that
it's really quite sad, isn't it? There's something wrong there completely if that's the start of someone's
Cumulative toll of just focusing on grades and test scores and not learning and having fun. I mean, learning's fun. We love learning. We're wired to learn. We're wired to figure stuff out without incentive or without threat of punishment. And grades, I think, have just, this is my one person's opinion, but grades have become just that. Do it or else. And if you learn something along the way, great. And it's why, again, South by Southwest EDU is seems to be a lot of folks who agree that that's a problem we need to fix. And then there's a lot of, again, there's a lot of students who are thriving too. So how do we look at what they're doing and replicate that? Because I think once, what I've seen is once students do get over that idea that grades don't equal happiness, that, that it's more community and learning, the college students who do that, and there's many of them, they have an amazing experience. And they're the ones who are taking advantage of all of the high impact programs that you hear about in the presentations here.
Absolutely. Obviously the podcast comes from a sort of tech innovation perspective. So I just wondered, within some of the programs that you're doing, whether tech has a part to play in that or some of the innovations that you've
It's an interesting intersection, because I think for me, and you know, there's growing you know, counter dialogue to tech, is that if, you know, if we just, technology is essentially is making things go faster. And if we make bad things go faster, if we make bad pedagogy, bad relationships, bad, if we make bad things go faster, it just gets a lot worse. You know, social media is a good example where, if you if you have authentic relationships on social media, that's an amazing thing. If you have inauthenticity in spaces like that, it can really exacerbate loneliness and other things. And so for me, I think one of my, you know, interest here is, if you're going to have a makerspace, how is it inclusive and diverse? If you're going to have technology, how is it sustainable and open and affordable? But just in terms of some of the other things, I mean, there's so many learning tools here, again, like gaming and interactive media, that can just really, when facilitated, I think you still need a human, and it's so great what you can do.
Well, I saw you're a fan of gaming, and I think you mentioned Comic-Con before. Are you sticking around for the gaming media part of the?
I am here until Thursday, and then I have to leave. But I get some of that in LA as well, places like IndieCade and things like that. But yeah, there's so much. I mean, gaming has been dominated by, you know, first person shooters and other things. But the technology, or even just analog board games and deck based games, I've learned so much from some of my friends and colleagues who are professors in game studies, who just do amazing things at, you know, at the core, how we play is how we live, and we can learn a lot of self-awareness, at least I do, every time I pick up a new game that is focused on some sort of social interaction.
Yeah, it's like finding out who cheats in Monopoly first.
So. Exactly, yeah. who shakes the board when...
Stealing money from the bank.
Classic.
It's a classic move. And then, do you have any books, resources, or people that you think sort of impacted how you've approached your, either your work life or your sort of philosophy of learning that you just mentioned, that you'd like to share with some of the listeners?
Yeah, you know, I think first and foremost, I would just say your own students. I learn, and again, there's been so many books and podcasts and, you know, conferences, but for me, it's, you know, sometimes in education, we get obsessed with our own esoteric languages and acronyms. If I was to make one universal change, I would say no more acronyms in education. It tells people, you know, you don't belong here. I think listening to your own students. But for me, you know, one of the core books that I read that I've, you know, given to the most people and I cite as a big turning point was Simon Sinek's Start With Why. And it was actually, again, one of our students that brought it to my attention when it had first come out. I think it was 2008 or so. And that that concept gave a framework for me to share with others how I would always felt. Like, you know, if, and we heard it in the opening keynote this morning, if you're showing up to South by Southwest just to sell a product, and you're not sincerely interested in the why first of helping school be amazing, and your tech tool is just on the path to doing that, then you shouldn't be here. And so I think if I was to cite one book that was sort of that big turning point, was it would be Start With Why.
Amazing. Yeah. And then if people want to follow you, your big
Bean. So it's at Beanpole underscore Brian, a very unfortunate nickname that kind of stuck. I didn't know Twitter would stick around. So yeah.
This is not 100% babe or something.
Yes, yes. At Beanpole underscore Brian.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you.
So just finished watching the Tim Ferriss keynote, which included at the tail end an interesting onstage performance by an attendee who wanted to make a statement about the International Women's Day, and revealed himself to be wearing a dress. So that was quite interesting. And now I'm delighted to be here with Dhaval Shah, who is founder of Class Central. So welcome.
Good to be here.
And so could you tell us a little bit about Class Central? Because I'm a big fan. And I mean, just for those people listening, essentially what you do is aggregate information about all the various online courses and MOOCs or whatever acronym you want to call them, so people can get an understanding of, if I'm a learner, what course I want to take, but also if I'm interested in the sector, you know, where revenue is being made and the sort of development of MOOCs as it's progressed.
Yes, so there are like two sides to Class Central. One is the one side where it's the product, where people can find courses, MOOCs from all over the world. We keep a very close eye on MOOCs from universities across the world. So we have more than 700 universities that are offering online courses now.
Yeah.
And we are the only ones with a complete record of that those courses. We have tens of thousands of reviews from users, so you can decide which course is, if a course is good for you.
Yeah.
We also categorize courses manually so that you can browse courses by your interest rather than just a search. Most people don't know what they want to learn. That's why we spend a lot of time categorizing it manually.
Yeah, and you said that this was launched about 4 years ago, is that correct?
November 2011, so okay. So I was October 10, 2011 was when the first three Stanford courses went live. I was taking one of them from Sebastian Thrun. And in end of November, more of these courses were being announced. And at that time, they were just Stanford online courses. And they were all on different domain names. HCI-class.org, ML-class.org, AI-class.org. So I just flipped it, class.central.com.
Yeah.
And created a one-page site which had like 13, 14 of these courses. And overall, Thanksgiving weekend, I don't think I spoke to anyone on that weekend, and I just built it, launched it, and put it as a GitHub project, and it's still open source on GitHub.
That's madness, because you were just telling me that this is a side project.
It was a side project for the first 2 years, but now it's full time.
Got you. Yeah, now I was going to say, you're like a superhuman.
It would be impossible even.
Yeah, that's
there's
what I thought.
Too much happening right now. And I said, this is the first part of the business, and the second part of the business is the reports. Like, we have a blog, which we call it MOOC Report.
Yep.
And I try to write what's happening in the MOOC space as it happens.
Yes.
And we try to publish our own stats, a lot of, like, how many MOOCs are there, how many universities are offering them, how many students are taking online courses right now.
Yeah.
We do an end-of-year article, which we've also published on EdSurge. These are the stats that everybody uses.
And so how did you come about having access to those statistics?
Good portion of the stats are our own stats. Since I was right from the beginning, November 2011, right? So I was there right at the beginning. I have a complete historical record of all the courses that were being offered. So I have this graph called Growth of MOOCs, which shows how many courses are being offered every year, every month. And so that's our own data, just because we're right from there. And then
is it all publicly available? Or you know, do you have your contacts within the university allow you to share that data?
No, we aggregate it. So yeah. we aggregate courses, and it's become a bit easier. It's still a lot of work, but at the same time, it's become easier because now that we are well known in our world, people reach out to us.
Yep.
So when a new university launches a course on their own platform or on their own small domain name or something, they reach out to us and we can list it.
Yeah.
So we keep track of independence that others can't, because it's difficult to know if they exist or not.
Got you. What's catching your attention in the MOOC world?
Oh, there's so much going on, right? I try to keep track of, you know, see what everybody's doing and see which ones are trends and which ones are just like one-off.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this last few months and this year, it seems degrees are the new thing.
So doing whole complete degrees
online. So it's mm-hmm. not really a MOOC, but the MOOC providers are interested in offering degrees. They're pushing for degrees. FutureLearn has one. EdX has recently announced OMS Analytics with Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
It is similar to the Udacity and Georgia Tech online Masters in Computer Science degree. Coursera has two degrees from University of Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. So they're pushing forward with degrees. This degrees is one thing, and the second one is corporate learning.
Yeah, and I remember looking at one of your previous reports, and it basically suggested that in terms of revenues, that's where online training or online courses were starting to see traction in terms of revenue as well.
They're making some traction, but they're still they're pretty far away. I think there are many well-established players in the corporate learning space who are only in the corporate learning space, so most people don't know about them.
Yes.
And but they are very well established. And but
have you got some example company names there?
I have digged through them. I think SuccessFactors is one.
Okay. So they're more mainstream, and then but in their particular
yeah
area.
Like as a consumer, I'd never heard. You will never hear about them. You'll probably hear if you work in a big company and they give you access. And these companies create content. Lynda.com is another player which has corporate government contracts and libraries. If you're part of a local library, you might get access to Lynda. So they already have established all these channels. The big providers have the content, and they want to. Now they're trying to break into all these companies. And, you know, the advantage is like, first of all, most users don't want to pay. Normal people, but the companies want to play a lot. They have big budgets. So the advantage is you go to a company and they can give you a couple of million check every year, a couple of million dollars. So you know, it's much easier than being in the consumer space. Consumer space is like you have to make that sale again and again.
Yes. I mean, before we started recording, we were chatting about sort of how the convergence of consumer and education and you know, your own self-description isn't one of ed tech, and it's more about perhaps tracking that consumer space as well.
Yeah, I consider Class Central to be in the consumer space, not in the education space.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody sleeps and everybody learns. So, you know, I don't think, you know, not all of us are in the sleep industry. So that's why I think education is something that everybody needs to do.
Yes.
And we should treat it as, make it as accessible as you can buy food or, you know, like you have so many resources. When you go to Amazon, you have so many reviews, so many ways to decide.
Yeah,
and that kind of is missing in the education space. It's too distributed. There are too many. I mean, we only focus on free online courses from universities. So we only focus on a very narrow margin of the whole online education, narrow portion of the, and we, you know, we need more resources to keep track of it. So that's our goal, is to make sure, like, be like that Amazon or be like that Yelp, where you find everything and you have enough information to decide if a course is right for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because one of the difficult problems when it's an intro to statistics from a top university, it's not the same as intro to statistics from Khan Academy.
Mm-hmm.
Intros courses for those were built for like really smart people, and sometimes there's a lot of misalignment. Students think, you know, students can fall into the trap thinking it's an intro course, but it's really not.
Got you. Yeah. So is there a space and an opportunity for those more introductory parts of the content before students jump into something that's a bit?
Yeah, I think providers have learned that too. I think they're getting intro is the early MOOC, like the one of the early adopters, like me, sort of we are being left behind with, because there's advanced courses have sort of declined.
Yeah.
As monetization has become more and more priority, you need bigger audiences. So there.
So it becomes very broad brush type thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's still good high quality content and advanced content, but generally it's the focus is more on intro level content right now. And as I guess as people get, people finish these courses, there are enough people for intermediate and advanced, then you'll get more and more of that. Certain fields have advanced courses, like you can find really good advanced courses in deep learning or, you know, some, because MIT and Stanford or some of these people keep releasing courses online.
Yeah.
So you get advanced courses in those fields, but a lot of fields are more on the intro level right now.
And whereabouts are you based?
I'm based in California, Mountain View, so the Bay Area.
Okay, and then what's your kind of background in terms of how you got into this and, you know, your own experience on education? Because I always ask all of the interviewees this.
So I did an undergrad in electronics and telecommunication back in India. And then I was very lucky to switch. I got into computer science in Georgia Tech here. I don't know why I got in. I got rejected from a lot of universities, which were supposed to be very easy to get into, and Georgia Tech was the best in my list. But that's when I found that education can be actually be life-changing. It was the first time I had access to quality education and also the people around me. It's not just the curriculum or it's the courses. It's,
yeah.
And it was like, I was mind-blown by it. And because I realized like I was a victim of mediocre education all my life. But 2 years are not enough to overcome that. And I actually had trouble clearing technical interviews.
Yeah.
I couldn't get into Silicon Valley companies, so I even interviewed in 2012, early 2012. I interviewed both at Coursera and Udacity. I couldn't get into it, and Class Central was launched. That's why I got the interview. So that's why I got. I was looking for courses to help me finish that gap of like clearing the technical interviews. And when I saw these sort of Stanford courses pop up, I knew that there's this data structure class that I want to do. It will come up. So I got excited. I built this one-page site over a weekend, put it on GitHub. It's still on GitHub right now. You can see it. And just launched it. And a few months later, I did one course. At that time, I was in Dallas. A few months later, I did a course from Coursera, from Stanford, which taught about algorithms and data structures. And then I finally cleared my first real tech interview and found a job in Silicon Valley.
And who was that with?
It was with reputation.com.
Yeah.
And then after being here, after being like there for a year, you're in Silicon Valley. At no point when I started my side project, I had like startup, you know. But once you come to Silicon Valley, that...
Yeah. It gets into your system. It's around
you all the time. And then I also saw that, you know, this was a trend. This was not just like U.S. universities. I could see that all like universities and governments all around the world are sort of gearing up to offer courses.
Oh, I love the fact that you know, but you're also a user of those courses, so you get it. You get what you can experience that from the learner's point of view as well. And then, how many people do you have come to your site now?
Last month was a big month, but usually around 400,000 to 500,000 monthly uniques.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So.
Awesome. And so this week, South by Southwest EDU, what kind of conversations have you heard here and conversations that you've had that have been relevant to MOOCs or higher education institutions, learning in general?
I think in the edtech world itself, the MOOCs is a dirty word.
And do you recognize the term MOOCs or do you talk about online learning? So.
It depends who I'm talking to.
Yeah.
If I think they know about MOOCs, I say MOOCs, or I just say online courses.
Yeah,
and you know, that term is more marketing friendly. It doesn't really mean what it means now.
Yeah.
So I think that's why the sessions are like a lot of, at one point there was a session early on, like a few years ago, where Anant Agrawal and Andrew Ng were on stage. You know, that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the sessions are MOOC sessions are not accepted.
It's really fascinating. I think the term MOOC has become a bit outdated, but I think, you know, the kind of momentum behind what's happening is still absolutely happening. Like you see Oxford University just opened a MOOC and so that's an interesting observation.
Yeah, I mean, it's only in the edtech world. That's why I say I'm in the consumer world. Mm-hmm. MOOCs are still a nice name when you go to normal people. So normal people love the word, love the concept.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't like that some of them are getting more, like you have to pay for them now. But yeah. Generally, it's the consumer world is very happy with the idea of free online courses.
Okay, and then so if people want to contact you, how can they go about doing that if they're listening in?
If you go to classcentral.com, class-central.com, if you scroll down all the way, there's a link for an email.
Yep.
And it goes to contact@classcentral.com, which is actually just my email. It's just an alias, so it comes directly to me.
Yeah.
Or you can just my first name at class-central.com.
So. That's great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Big shout out to this week's sponsors, GLISA EDU. GLISA is an audience engagement platform, and they also have an education offer for socializing lectures, where they take regular PowerPoint or keynote presentations and push each slide out live to students' mobile devices as they are presented. Professors, administrators, and students get valuable data on where information is really engaging or needs reworking, and staff and students can interact through the deck. You can check them out at glissa.com/student-engagement. So I'm here with Nicholas Ljunggard.
Correct.
Excellent. Who's the CEO of SCORE from Sweden. So Nicholas, to kick off, can you tell us a little bit about what SCORE is?
Of course. Well, SCORE is a game-based recruitment company. We're in Stockholm. We are testing skills globally. We are working with 400 universities and companies worldwide and have a community of around 800,000 people that has gone through our online challenges and basically answered a lot of difficult questions where we find out what they're good at and connect them with great opportunities.
So when you say game-based, what does that mean in sort of in a practical term? So what kind of game?
A game could be that we use small elements such as countdowns and instant feedback, basically to, let's say that you compete for a job and at Toyota or at Volvo or something like that. And then we ask them a series of questions related to the automotive industry and perhaps some of the other problem-solving capabilities that you need in order to succeed in your job.
Yeah.
So they go through a series of challenges where we use small gamification features to drive that engagement.
Interesting. So it's also prepping students for that kind of actual world of work as opposed to kind of the more theoretical side sometimes from, you know, if they're straight out of university and still stuck in sort of the academic mindset, should we say?
Yeah, I think it's like three things that I'm passionate about. One is to create a rewarding recruiting experience. So, you know, in the old days, or basically what's happening now, is that you send in your CV and your cover letter that you spend 10 hours on into a black hole of applications, and you don't get as much as a thank you note.
Yeah.
So what if you can make the actual application process more rewarding? Giving people feedback, making them actually learn things while they're in the process of applying to a job or an education.
Interesting.
So that is, for me, extremely important. And the other thing is that recruitment is biased, meaning that you sort through the same static pile of dumb CVs or applications, and you do not broaden in the recruitment channels and look beyond ethnicity, country of origin, last name, the name of your education, and instead to look at who are you? How good are you at the moment? And how relevant is this person right now?
In terms of your role, does any of that information go on to the actual recruiter? So obviously the prep bit I get, but is there kind of then a specific connection between that student applicant and the recruiting company as well?
Yeah, we collect a wealth of data. So we know everything about how a person perform against their peers and also how good this company or university is in attracting a skilled crowd of people from what channel. So we supply back data about how people perform And if you have on average 1,000 people competing for this position, then of course it's a lot of interesting stats there.
Mm-hmm.
Where are skilled people from? What channels are best?
But you mentioned the unconscious bias piece. So is that anonymized from the employer point of view in terms of name and...
That would be the future, I would say, because it's difficult to change, transform the market now.
Mm-hmm.
But and some actors are actually starting to scrap the sort of diploma or look beyond, you know, the traditional resumes, like Ernst & Young in UK released a news about that last year. But what I know is the future, that 5 or 10 years from now,
mm-hmm.
companies, universities cannot afford to be biased, because then you will miss out on fantastic individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are millions of people out there, but you just need that perfect one.
Well, that's also an interesting sort of point, because then at the moment you work with universities, right? So, but then there's also fantastic candidates that aren't going through the university process. So I suppose in the future, you know, it might be working with further education colleges or, you know, other diverse sort of learning institutions.
Exactly. And we are helping with like bridging this skills gap that everybody's talking about and everybody knows is true. I think it was stated yesterday that, you know, 96% of all presidents in universities believe that they had the adequate education and the right skilled people graduating from their colleges.
I saw that.
Whereas 11% of the students actually think that they have the right skills needed for the jobs.
Yeah.
So think about this. What if it doesn't matter how you learned, as long as you have got the knowledge that it takes for this position? Then all of a sudden it doesn't really matter, and you can come from self-taught backgrounds, learn by internships, learn by online educations, learn by traditional education.
We were chatting before about the institutions that you work with. So at the moment, that's universities all around the world. Can you tell us a little bit about how long you've been going for, what you've learned, and, you know, partnering with some of those universities and how that's kind of playing out in reality?
Yeah, so we work with both great big employers, companies, but also around 250 universities worldwide. And what we see is they are digitalizing their way that they are like recruiting and assessing, enrolling and upskilling people. And university clients that we have, such as University of Edinburgh or London Business School, they are basically opening up their recruitment channels using more digital tools to find the best qualified people to apply. And we do everything from Stockholm. So if you ask me how far we've come, we fought with blood, sweat and tears the first years, the inception of the company, and basically created success stories, worked through storytelling to spread the message and the power and the return on investment that we can create.
Yeah.
And now, of course, since we have done this for a while, we rely a lot on the inbound type of marketing as well.
And what's the business model? Where do you make your money from?
Well, they use our platform, score.com, so they basically for a monthly charge they get access to use the tool for the recruitment, and then we have a lot of marketing channels, university partners and so on that we reach out through. So depending on how big your needs are, then we
Pay you, employers or the universities?
Universities and employers.
Interesting. And how did you get into all of this? What's your own educational background and how did you get into founding this company?
Part of this started back when I was like 15, you know, becoming a man. And that was basically that I was unable to put the finger on my talent.
Mm-hmm.
What was I good at? And I couldn't really find the right forum to show what my skills were. But I knew that if I'm getting into the right type of setting and use my full energy, I will be able to make some strong impact. And then I have a strong personal belief that every single person on earth sits on this X factor, which in the right forum will shine.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit like the Warhol, you know, famous for 15 minutes, that, you know, everybody has a unique set of skills that should be cultivated and basically exposed. And this is a long answer to your question, but what that turned out to be was that I was also competing a lot in university, case competitions, business plan competitions, and so on. And we saw that that brings something very strong within people, and it provides an alternative way to show what you're good at.
Mm-hmm.
So that was...
Which is the like gamification part of your website as well, so the competing. Correct. And yeah. How can people connect with you?
They can connect with me through you, I guess.
Yeah? Or are you on Twitter, for example?
I'm on Twitter, I'm on LinkedIn.
Yeah?
What's your Facebook.
Do you remember what your Twitter handle is?
It's Niklas Ljunggard.
Okay, excellent. So I'll put that in the show notes, everyone. Brilliant. Well,
niklas@score.com. You can reach me on
that. It's been great to enjoy this Austin view with you and the Austin breeze.
It's been a nice day. It's been a very nice day. I was speaking yesterday, and okay. It's just a crazy schedule, but it's a great event and very spot on for what we do.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this week's interview, everyone. Next week, we will be back with our third South by Southwest EDU 2017 EdTech Trends episode, looking at investment, startups and accelerators. In the meantime, don't forget to check out our listener survey and have a great week.